All right, you want to grab this mic? And anyone who has questions, let me know, raise your hand, and I'll bring the mic so that the doctor doesn't have to repeat the question.
I actually have two questions, doctor. Number one is, I've heard of positive and negative things about tofu. Is it beneficial for us to eat or include tofu in our diet?
Okay. Tofu goes along with the discussion about soy and soy products, and is it beneficial, is it not beneficial? There is a bit of confusion when it comes to looking at the studies and the research related to it. I think the confusion is simply because people aren't paying attention to the type of soy products that are being used in the different studies. So if you start looking through the different soy products, the ones that are highly processed, like your textured vegetable protein, hydrolyzed soy protein, and so on, then we're having negative effects associated with those. And the studies that are showing the consumption of fairly unprocessed soy, like edamame, which is the green soybeans, regular soybeans, tofu, and even the studies looking at tempeh, are showing that there are positive effects associated with its consumption. There are a number of studies that show that increased soy consumption in the diet decreases risk for a number of different things, including several cancers, including breast cancer, and also for cardiovascular disease and a few other conditions as well. It helps with weight loss in individuals that are on a alternative protein consumption plan because it replaces the animal proteins, which also go along with lots of fats, with a plant protein that goes along with lots of fiber. So there are those benefits. Now, when it comes to, let's say, female hormones and the whole soy issue, there's a concern that genistein and one of the other phytonutrients that are have a similar structural has a similar structure to estrogen, and they're considered phytoestrogens or plant-based estrogens. Would they have or create problems with estrogen-sensitive tumors? So breast cancer that is estrogen receptor positive, ovarian tumors, endometrial or cervical cancer, and its effect on that. There was initial concerns because of that estrogen-like property, and what the studies have been kind of panning out since that time is that soy is actually protective against breast cancer for a number of reasons. One is that soy has an epigenetic effect, meaning that soy can affect the epigenome, which is the molecules inside the nucleus that help to regulate the transcription of DNA so that it can either upregulate or downregulate certain genes. And soy has the effect of downregulating the transcription of breast cancer-associated genes. Also, soy has been shown to stimulate the beta estrogen receptor, which until a few years ago, they didn't know that there was a difference between the estrogen receptors. They just thought it was an estrogen receptor. Well, they found out that there are alpha and beta estrogen receptors, and soy predominantly stimulates the beta receptor, and the beta receptor tends to have an opposite response as the alpha receptor, and so it basically decreases estrogenic types of effects in the body. So it helps from that standpoint. The studies, there are some studies that show that soy intake decreases one's risk of developing breast cancer in the first place. There are other studies that show that soy intake, when somebody has breast cancer, increases survival and decreases recurrence rates. And so on. And I've got a presentation somewhere with a number of references to studies showing those particular effects. And so what we usually recommend to individuals is to consume soy, but to consume soy at an in a manner that is relatively unprocessed. And so for us, that's usually tofu, soybeans, or edamame, and preferably organic. But still, the studies show even if you're choosing organic or non-organic, I mean, if it's GMO, the studies are showing that there's a benefit to its consumption compared to not consuming it, and benefit to its consumption when it replaces meat or animal-based products.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. My second question, is it bad to drink water while we're eating?
It's better not to drink water while you're eating. Or other, lots of other liquids with your meal, because it just dilutes the digestive acids and the digestive enzymes, so that it makes it harder for the stomach to actually break things down. That's a dilutional effect predominantly. So if you're one that tends to be really thirsty around meals, it's nice to tank up on the water like a half an hour before your meal, and then have some later on, but not so much with your meals for that dilutional effect.
All right. There are many products out there that supposedly replace meat. And I was wondering, in the case of Stripples, do you know what I'm referring to?
I was brought up on bacon and eggs.
And I love the taste of bacon. Whereas the Stripples sort of have that taste. What do you think of those products?
I love Stripples.
I me too.
My favorite way of eating it actually is frozen. My favorite was just pulling it straight out of the freezer where it still had ice kind of hanging on it and eating it frozen. I didn't care if my mother, she wanted to heat it up and do whatever. I was like, just give it to me frozen. That's how I liked it. So I really like the taste of Stripples, but I haven't eaten Stripples in years, because I realize that it's probably healthier not to. Those meat analogs have a good purpose. They have a good purpose. And so if you have somebody that is used to being on an animal-based diet and they're struggling with the idea of getting off of that animal-based diet and switching to something that's more plant-based, more power to you, go ahead, use it in that transitional process. And but we do need to recognize that a lot of those alternatives are fairly highly processed. They usually come along with a lot of fat and a lot of salt in order to make them flavorful and have a flavor that's similar to the meat products that they're looking to substitute. So they're better than having the original product, and so in that way they're a good move. But some people land in transitional land, and then they never move out of it. And so transition ends up being just staple. And that was me. I was born in transition land. So I grew up with fried chicken, and I grew up with Stripples, and I grew up with Worthington chili, and I grew up with, all of these different things. And I have Veggie Links and Big Franks and all sorts of stuff. And I didn't realize that it was supposed to be transitional food. It was just a staple for me, and it wasn't until later that I realized that, hang on, there's probably better alternatives than this, and started then working out of it. So as a transitional food, yeah, great. Use it in that process of transitioning over, getting those taste buds changed, something that's healthier than what you had before, but then don't get stuck there. Continue looking for ways of improving and getting better over time.
I think you've answered most of it, but that's exactly what I was saying, because especially I come from Africa, and the church has actually allowed people to think that transitional food is the only thing, and is very high in sodium, and is the church and you, your group, especially for people who are in the healthcare thing, are they trying to advocate for the church to move towards moving from that kind of substance?
Yeah, it would be, again, it's the idea really is something better, right? Moving from where you're at to something better. There's a whole spectrum when it comes to health and how bad things are for you, and you can be on the methamphetamine, cocaine, ecstasy side of things where you're just, you know, killing yourself horribly, and then if you do eat, then you're eating meat and milk and all that kind of stuff. Well, if you're coming from that standpoint and you're thinking, well, let's switch from red meat to white meat, good, good. Move in a better direction, right? And if you're in the red meat versus white meat camp and you're thinking, well, I don't know, maybe I should try some of these transitional foods, good, move in that direction. And part of what I'm trying to paint for individuals this weekend is an idea of the goal, right, of the target at the end of the road, but recognizing that individuals are going to take time to get there, right? And it's going to be each individual's experimentation with it and figuring out what's going to work for you and how fast you can transition and so on. Just keeping the goal in mind that, you know, something better. So once you get in somewhere and settled with that, then start asking, okay, well, what can I do better? And then once you get there, then asking yourself, what can I do better? And just kind of moving along that way.
Okay. Did I hear you say that L-carnosine is or is connected with laughing gas?
It was L-arginine.
Arginine, yeah.
Not L-carnitine. Different amino acids. L-arginine, it is one of the base products that the endothelium, the inside lining of the arteries, that it uses in the process of producing laughing gas or nitric oxide. And so by supplementing the L-arginine, you're providing that base product that the endothelium needs in order to produce the nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is a very potent vasodilator. So it causes the smooth muscles to relax, the blood vessels to dilate, and when they dilate, it decreases the blood pressure.
Is it okay if we institute this program after Thanksgiving?
I am not the Lord, so that you work that out with God, and if God says sure, do that after Thanksgiving, then do it after Thanksgiving. Yeah, losing weight and diabetes.
Mm-hmm. Someone said that we needed the. Tomorrow's session on depression after all these sessions.
Well, maybe it's providential that it's going to be tomorrow. Yeah.
While I go to just two words, not a question, gluten-free.
Uh-huh. We'll get to it. Gluten-free. It can be beneficial for a number of individuals. There are more and more people that we're discovering have celiac disease, which is a condition where you cannot tolerate gluten in any of its forms, and sometimes you can even be violently sick with a single crumb. And that is a lot of my family, my grandfather, my aunt, my cousin, my mother, my sister, all of them have celiac disease. And I have not tested whether I have it or not, but I have tested to see whether there was any difference. And so we've done like 6 weeks of gluten-free and then went back to having a gluten feast, and there was no difference in anything. And so I don't think yet that I have problems with it. But there are individuals that even outside of celiac disease, they don't have a diagnosis of it. The blood tests don't. Show that they have celiac disease. There are many individuals that have gluten sensitivity, and so they can have all sorts of symptoms. And with gluten sensitivity and even with celiac disease, it's interesting because the manifestations of it can be so varied, it's difficult to nail it down. Sometimes it's years that individuals are going to their physicians and trying to figure out why they have headaches or why they have other neurologic problems or why they have joint pains or why they have this or that or the other thing. And it's not until years down the road that they find out that, oh, they've got celiac disease or they've got gluten intolerance, and once you cut the gluten out of their diet, boom, symptoms go away. Well, it shouldn't be like boom, but within a few days or so of going gluten-free, their thinking clears up, their arthritis goes away, all of these different things. And everybody in my family has had different presenting symptoms associated with their celiac disease. So one of them was having significant neurologic issues. Another person had bad gastrointestinal stuff. Another one was having like migraines and so on. And so all sorts of different manifestations associated with it. Does that mean that everybody needs to go gluten-free? No. But if you've got a number of symptoms that are going on, I don't know, it might be beneficial if you're at that place in your, you know, in your life and your diet and your frustration with whatever thing's going on, it might be beneficial to do a gluten-free challenge for, you know, 4 to 6 weeks or so, and then dine on gluten. You know, you cut it out for 4 to 6 weeks, and then you just have a feast with lots of gluten. And see what happens. If your symptoms went away while you were off of it, and then you ate it again, and boom, everything comes back, well, you've just convinced yourself that might be a good idea to go gluten-free. If, like what I did, you don't have any difference, can't notice anything in between, well, go ahead and continue consuming it.
Based on the plant food, there is any specific plant that will be good for your joints?
Any specific plant that will be good for your joints? Well, I don't know about any specific plant that's good for your joints. Most of them are good for your joints. As far as consuming, you're talking about, right? Yeah. Consuming, most of them are good for that. There are some individuals that have gluten sensitivity, and the manifestation is joint pain or arthralgias. And when you cut out the gluten, then the joint pain goes away. Now, there's another category of plant foods that are perfectly good in and of themselves, but can contribute to arthralgias or arthritis pain, joint pain, and those are nightshades. So some individuals are sensitive to nightshades. Nightshades include tomatoes, white potatoes, eggplant, peppers, all types of peppers, even the sweet peppers, also includes okra and tobacco, and tomatillas. And no, not necessarily seeds. So those are your nightshades. So white potatoes, tomatoes, and then peppers, eggplant, tomatillas, and what did I say, okra, tobacco. And they're all in the tobacco family, actually. And not that all of them have nicotine. And so some individuals are sensitive to those nightshades, and when you cut all the nightshades out, the arthritis pain goes away, or it gets significantly better. And so that's something that we'll do for individuals at the Lifestyle Center. If they come and, you know, there's a primary complaint or a major complaint of joint pains, then we'll try a nightshade-free, gluten-free diet for a while and see if that clears anything up. If it doesn't seem like it's working, that's fine. We'll just, you know, put it right back in the diet and see. And you usually know within a couple days, 2 or 3 days of cutting it out, whether there's an effect or not. But then the rest of the foods, yeah, they're pretty good for the joints. Individuals that have joint problems, ultimately there's a problem with blood flow, because the cartilage of the joint has no blood vessels in it. It only has blood vessels going along the surface of it. And so it's very sensitive to changes in blood flow. And if you have too little blood flow, then you're going to have problems with keeping the chondrocytes or the cells that maintain it. You're going to have trouble keeping them alive. And then the integrity of the cartilage that it produces. For example, individuals that have, we usually think of joints here, but in the back, where you have the joints in between the vertebrae, the discs. When you look at discs, and you look at it with magnetic resonance angiograms, MRAs, and you're looking at the small blood vessels that feed the discs, almost every study that I know of that has looked at it shows that the discs that are bad, where you start having disc bulging and then disc herniation, there's poor blood flow going to the disc. So it's actually cardiovascular disease in those small little blood vessels that are supplying the discs that then lead the disc to be dehydrated, because if you see an MRI report with a low back, it'll say that the disc is desiccated. That means it's dehydrated. Well, if you drive a long distance on a flat tire, it's not going to do so well. If it's, you know, and same type of idea, that disc becomes kind of like a flat tire. Now it's more susceptible to changes in pressure and then bulging and so on. Then you get a bulging disc, and then it can pop. The fibrous cap can pop, and the gel inside can burst out and then push on nerves and spinal cord and so on and create problems. And then similar blood flow issues can cause problems with joints. So if you have joint pain, don't stop walking, don't stop exercising, don't stop whatever just because you have the pain. Continue pushing through it. The individuals that lose their joints faster are the ones that stop exercising because of the pain. The ones that keep the joints longer are the ones that continue exercising, because you get that squish, release, squish, release, squish, release on the joints, and it's a sponging action that draws in the nutrients and pulls it through the cartilage so that you can keep those chondrocytes alive. And then, of course, staying well hydrated, drinking lots of fluids and so on is beneficial.
What do you know about CBD oil?
CBD oil, it comes from, of course, the cannabis plant, and the CBD oil, compared to marijuana, marijuana has, THC is the psychoactive chemical or component of marijuana that gives kind of the euphoria, the high, and then the, you know, changes in thinking and perception. In a regular marijuana plant, you're looking at about 12 or 13% THC. In CBD oil, it's supposed to be about 0.3% or less, depending on which manufacturer and which CBD oil that you're getting. So the content of THC is quite a bit less. There is still some of the THC in it. The only studies that I'm aware of that are convincing as far as its effectiveness is in pediatric seizure disorder with certain genetic seizure conditions that children have, and using the CBD oil to decrease the frequency of seizures or increase the seizure threshold. There's a number of studies showing that it's beneficial from that standpoint. There's questions about its anti-inflammatory effect and its use in a number of other situations, but the research is not very strong in the other areas, and since it still contains some of the THC, I'm not a big fan. We don't use it at the Lifestyle Center. But if we have individuals that come on CBD oil, I'm okay with them continuing it, or we try alternatives and see how it's, you know, how it works and so on. But I don't actually put people on CBD oil. And then there's the related question that has to do with hemp seed, because hemp seed also comes from the cannabis plant. The studies show that the seed and the stem of the plant do not contain any THC. And so hemp seeds do not contain the THC or the psychoactive component to it. And it's actually a very concentrated plant protein source. So individuals can, we're perfectly fine in using the hemp seed. I think we had a question over here.
Well, I walked to Daryl, organic.
If you can, great. Yeah, so organic. If you are in the position financially and location wise and whatever that you can do organic, fine, do organic. If you're not, well, don't worry about it. It's not a big issue, I don't think. That it's a huge issue to fight over, but you know, do the best that you can with what you've got.
In regards to low blood flow and discs, herniation or bulging discs, surgeries, what causes the low blood flow, and what do you recommend for somebody that has a bulging disc and herniated disc and have been
recommended to have
surgery. The cause for the poor blood flow is cardiovascular disease. So the same development of cholesterol plaques. It's just that these are smaller arteries than the arteries that supply the heart. And so it's easier to fill up those arteries first and start decreasing blood flow than it is to the heart. And so how do you end up reversing that process? Well, you end up reversing it just like you would do with heart disease, just like Caldwell-Esselstyn has demonstrated at Cleveland Clinic, that if you're on a strictly plant-based diet, and he says, how many oils? No oil. All right. He's not a big fan of nuts either. And we've talked about that, and he, you know, he's got his opinion, I've got mine. Completely plant-based diet, exercise on a regular basis, cutting the oils down significantly, and so total oil content or fat content is really about 10% of the diet or less, which is really low, that you can reverse cardiovascular disease and plaque size by about 30% on average over the next 18 to 36 months. It's the only thing, dietary interventions are the only thing that has been shown in research to actually reverse cardiovascular disease. And the same things that reverse cardiovascular disease in the coronary arteries that supply the heart are the same ones that do so in the arteries that go up to the brain and the arteries that go to reproductive organs and the arteries that go to discs and so on and so forth. Now, if your disc has already bulged and it's already herniated, the likelihood is it's probably not going to unherniate, and it's not going to not bulge the rest of your life, but you can get to a situation where you don't have to necessarily have surgery associated with it. Individuals that have disc herniation, nowadays, in fact, they usually won't do surgery until you're at least 8 weeks out from your initial event, because they know that within about 8 weeks, the majority of individuals will resolve the pain at least to a tolerable amount or a tolerable degree so that they don't have to have surgery. So what are some things that helps out with that? One of them is physical therapy and core body stabilization. What is that? Well, you're working on abdominal exercises, you're working on back exercises, you're working on gluteal and thigh exercises in order to strengthen those muscles that are your core stabilizers. Because other than the muscles, you only have a single column of bone that's holding the top of your body to the lower part of the body together. So the stronger those muscles are, the more it helps in stabilizing that spine so that the spine isn't taking a lot of that pressure. What's that?
Planking.
Like planking? That can be... Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, strengthening coordination is helpful there. There are some other things that are beneficial. One of them is an inversion table. And the inversion table basically is a flat table where you basically hook your ankles in and then the thing can flip upside down so that you're hanging by your ankles. And it can go to various different degrees so that your head's only down a little bit or more, or you're just dangling. And get the more expensive ones, because the cheaper ones, sometimes you can dangle and then...
Stay dangling,
right? Until somebody hears you yelling at them and so on. So, but anyways, that helps because now you have gravity that's doing the opposite thing. Instead of pushing the bones together and squishing the disc out, now you're having gravity help stretch it in between, and so that kind of decreases some of the bulging that's going on there. Another thing that's helpful is ice massage. And what that is you get, probably the easiest way is to get a styrofoam cup, 8 to 12 ounce cup, fill it about 4/5 of the way full of water, throw it in the, place it in the freezer and freeze it And then once it's frozen, you get the bottom inch or so, and you peel the styrofoam off of it so that you have the ice, and now you're not going to freeze your hand while you're using it. And then you basically you go in circles in the back over the area wherever the pain is, and usually it's the low back that you have pain. And so let's say that the pain is it's going to be lumbar. Let's say it's the right side that's giving you most of the problem. If I'm holding it here, I would be doing kind of a circular or an oval motion, not directly over the spine, but just off to the side over the musculature here, and kind of that oval motion around and around. You could be sitting on a towel in order to catch all of the water, or if you're doing it, you have two hands and you're not holding a microphone at the same time. So you do a couple of rounds, and then you use your other hand with a washcloth to dry it off, and then do it again, and then dry it, and then do it again, and then dry it, and you just keep that up. When you start, it feels cold. After a while, it starts feeling hot. If you do it a little bit longer, then it starts aching. You get this dull, like, toothache ache in there, and then if you keep doing it, it eventually goes numb. You want to go all the way until it goes numb, and then you can stop and leave it alone. And that can help out quite a bit with sciatic type of pain. It can give you pain relief for several hours. And even though it causes vasoconstriction and a lack of blood flow while you're doing it, the response is then vasodilation, because the longer you vasoconstrict a blood vessel and you cut off blood supply, you get a corresponding vasodilation and increased blood flow to the area later. To wash out the metabolic byproducts, to bring in more oxygen, more glucose, and so on, and you end up getting more blood flow overall because of that. And so that's another thing that you can do. Then, of course, heating pads and hot and cold treatments to the low back can be beneficial too.
This question is more in reference to the institution. Are there any insurance companies that work with you?
No. No. We have, what we do is we put together a billing statement for individuals that are interested, and we will put together a billing statement, an itemized statement, and give that to the individual. They can submit it to their insurance company for reimbursement for expenses already given. The insurance company doesn't have to go directly with the office. The individual can actually work with the insurance company as well. And so that's what we do, and people get variable amounts back depending upon their insurance company. I've heard of some individuals getting I've heard of some people getting nothing because their insurance company was not interested. And others have gotten 200. I think the most that I've heard is somebody said that their insurance company paid about 80% of the costs. So, you know, Blue Cross and Blue Shield's probably going to give you more money than Medicaid, just as they do with anything else. But we don't have the personnel, Medicaid, and Medicare. Yeah, Medicare would be better than Medicaid and so on. But it just depends on which insurance provider that you have as to how responsive they are. A lot of insurance providers don't recognize what we do as the practice of medicine. And so they aren't necessarily as happy to cover it. It looked like we were making some headway with Obamacare because there were a lot more codes in the healthcare program to cover counseling for obesity and counseling for different disease states and so on. But it's not really panning out, and we don't have the personnel to chase the insurance companies and try to get payments back for them. So, yes.
Gallbladder and gallbladder stones. Is that something? I've heard that, you know, doctors say that sometimes you have it and you don't have any symptoms until they get, you know, you can live your whole life and have some stones there and you're never going to have any symptoms unless they get, you know, bigger and everything. And then usually they tell you, go and have surgery and remove your gallbladder.
Yes, what you said is true. The gallstones, I'm trying to remember the statistics now. I think it is 25% of females that have made it to their 40s have gallstones, and the majority of them don't have any symptoms or problems associated with it, but then there are those that do. The gallbladder, it's like a balloon, and so you have kind of the open balloon part, and then you have the neck where it squirts the bile out, and then it goes down a duct and then into the digestive tract. And so if you have a stone in the bladder part, that's not a problem. It can sit there, and it can do whatever it wants to and kind of just be there. It's a problem when it gets into that neck, and then it gets stuck. And then the gallbladder is trying to squeeze and push out its bile, but it can't because the stone is stuck there at the end of it, and it can't get past that. And then it becomes inflamed, and then it can become infected, and so on. And yes, surgeons will generally look at it at that point and say, "Well, next, and let's go to surgery and take it out laparoscopically." And it's fairly common. It's the most common surgical procedure for general surgeons, and it's the second most common emergency, quotes, procedure for general surgeons. First is an appendectomy, removing the appendix. And can it be prevented? Probably. The major constituent of gallstones is cholesterol. So that's the major portion of it. They typically are cholesterol stones. So theoretically, decreasing the amount of cholesterol content in the diet and getting over the cholesterol issues that an individual might have has the potential for decreasing your risk for developing gallstones. If you have them already, is there anything that dissolves them away? I don't know. I'm not sure that there is. There are products out there that are called gallbladder flushes, and you might find a recipe for it online. The gallbladder flush usually involves an oil, an acid, and a salt. It'll have you drink a half a cup of olive oil with a lemon or a couple lemons, and then add some Epsom salt along with that, and you take all of this together, and then lo and behold, the next day when you go to the bathroom, you get all of these gallstone pebbles out in the stool. It's not. All it is a chemical reaction between the oil, the salt, and the acid in the stomach environment, and then with bile and so on, that just makes these little pebble-like. They're not really stones. They're actually fairly soft. If you cut them, they're clear and white on the inside. So most of it was formed before it ever got to the bile. It's not a gallstone. It's just a chemical reaction that happens with it. Now, if you are having problems with the gallbladder and gallstones, is there anything that you might be able to do? Yeah, potentially. Doing hot and cold fomentations over the gallbladder may be beneficial. Some individuals have received help by putting a charcoal poultice over the area of the liver, and potentially helping with some of the inflammation that's there, although some of the effect might simply be because of the accumulation of heat over the area, because the poultice will trap the heat over that spot. And fasting tends to be helpful for individuals that are having gallstone problems, and lots of water intake as well, and then making sure that you're not eating very much fats at all in the diet. All of those can be beneficial. But I'm not sure of anything that actually takes gallstones and removes them other than a surgeon. Yes.
Hi. Having been raised on sugar, let's say my father had a bakery, I was raised on sugar coming from a German family, and even now I'm in my 70s and I can't give up sugar. What would you suggest? Yeah, I have a sugar craving all day long.
Well, I would suggest that the thought that you can't give it up is a lie, or a deception, I should say. It's a self-deception. I'm going to pull a chair over here so I can sit down. I would say that the thought that you can't give it up is a deception. You can. It's possible. The question is, what do you need to determine, and who do you need to trust in that process so that you can give it up? It depends on the individual as to what method might work best in getting over a sugar craving. Sometimes, because of the addictive potential, the best thing is cold turkey, and kind of like ridding the house of sugar type products and just going cold turkey for a month or so. Taste buds change; they do. Now, cravings, that's an issue of the mind. It's not an issue of the taste buds or the stomach. It's actually an issue of the mind. And so one has to work on the thinking components associated with it as well. And then the question is, why? Why the craving? Is it simply because of familiarity? Most individuals have craving because there is something that is missing that they're looking for. And most individuals, it's because of love. Now, they might have relationships around them that are helpful, beneficial, and so on, but none of those relationships around them supplant the need for that relationship, right? The vertical relationship and the need for love that we have from God. And so most addictions really are based upon ultimately a need for love that's not fulfilled, and then a seeking to fulfill that in a different way. And then it's a cycle of using something, whether it's a substance or a behavior or images or whatever, that bring a euphoria that blunts the effect or the feeling of the loss of the thing that you need. And then after using it, then there's guilt thoughts, guilt feelings associated with it, and then the guilt hole contributes to the whole cycle. And so how do you get out of that whole cycle? Well, first of all, you got to take care of the guilt, which is what happens at the cross. You got to come to the cross and accept God's forgiveness for you, even in the midst of the situation, just like the woman who was brought to Jesus in the midst of her adultery. And what did he tell her? He said, he asked her, "Where are your accusers?" She says, "Nowhere." She says, "Neither do I accuse you. Go and sin no more." Right? So even in the midst of her sin, he went and set her free. And it's the same thing that he's looking to do for us, in the midst of our sin, to set us free, so that that guilt cycle doesn't continue to drive the addictive behaviors and continue on with that pattern. And then, of course, coming to him, the one that takes care of your guilt, and receiving of his love, accepting of that love, taking of that love, that it might be yours. And when you're full, you don't crave stuff. That's why it's so nice to go shopping on a full stomach. Because all you get is what you need, because you think about it and you go, okay, well, yeah, I'm going to need that, and I'm going to need that, and I'm going to need that. But when you go on an empty stomach, oh, yeah, I could eat that. Oh, yeah, I could eat that. Oh, yeah, and you buy a whole bunch more when you go on an empty stomach. So when you're full, it takes care of the craving. And the craving really is a craving for love. It's just been substituted with other things. And so recognizing that and then working at the foundation is something that's beneficial. Sugar addictions are similar to alcohol addictions. Actually, both of them are very closely tied to each other. The same metabolic processes that happen in the brain with both. And a lot of times if somebody was an alcoholic and they stop their alcoholism, they'll pick up a sugar addiction afterwards because the same pathways. Yeah.
Doctor, if you had a close family member who had any type of cancer, would you recommend? How would you decide whether you should say yes, go ahead and have chemo and radiation, or bring him to your clinic?
Well, I mean, it depends on who the individual is. I'm always interested in what the individual believes and what their convictions are, and then providing education. I don't want to make a decision for somebody else, but I just want to provide them the information that they need in order to make an informed decision and to go ahead and make that informed decision. And if I had a close family member, my wife, children, or whoever, that ended up with cancer and they said, well, I want to do chemotherapy and radiation, I'd present information to them and I'd say, okay, you still want to do that, then, you know, that's your choice. And I'm thinking of some of the older children. you know, but if it comes to myself and my own personal decision, I don't know. I might do radiation. It just depends. I've seen a lot of people that have gone through radiation, and they have a lot of pain and they have a lot of debility afterwards. Some people recover from that and do fairly well in the long run. I don't like the idea of using something to treat cancer that it causes cancer. And we know radiation is a cause for cancer, but I don't know. Am I chemotherapy? I don't think so. That's just my own personal, you know, my own personal decision based upon what I know of the body and its physiology and how healing comes about. And so, you know, if or when I develop cancer sometime in the future, because it's 1 in 2 for men and it's 1 in 3 for women right now, through lifetime risk for cancer. and so if that ends up being the case for me, then I know that there are areas in my life and lifestyle that I can improve on. Oh, really? Yeah, really. And I know that there's ways that I could be more strict in regards to things that I don't think right now that I have to be that strict in that area because I'm not treating a disease. I'm looking at maintaining health. But if I was in the case of treating a disease, then I would have different recommendations for myself. And I would use those things, and I would trust in the Lord and ask for him to work out his will and continue ministering and doing whatever he called me to do and taking of his love and giving that to others. And if he allows me to debilitate and go to sleep in that process, okay. I'm okay with that.
I have two questions. One is real fast. Last night you were talking about, you said prickly pear. Were you talking about the fruit or the actual, the green?
The actual green part of the cactus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Not actually the fruit, but the actual green.
The nopal.
The nopales.
Yeah. All right. That was one. The second one is, for the most part, I have a plant-based diet. And for the last couple of years, every time I get a blood work, like my B12 is like really low. Is that normal for someone that's plant-based or... But it's like low, like low.
Yeah. Well, it's...
almost non-existent. For real. Yeah. The last time, yeah.
All right. First of all, if that's the case, then you need to take a B12 supplement in order to... Right, okay. So, yeah, because you need a supplement for that. Because B12 deficiency, there's all sorts of things that can happen, specifically neurologic complaints that individuals have with B12 deficiency, and then you can have problems with developing, with making blood. The hemoglobin molecules and red blood cells tend to be large and so on, megaloblastic anemia that you can have with it. But B12, it's variable. We have tested individuals that have been vegan for 20 to 40 years, and they have normal B12 levels without supplementation. I have tested individuals that have been vegan for like a year, and they have low B12 levels. I have tested individuals that are on an animal-based diet, and they have low B12 levels. And I've tested other, and so it's all it's variable. It's all over the place. But it is true that in general, individuals that are on a whole food plant-based diet tend to have lower B12 levels, and they can encroach on the low range. And if that's the case, then B12 supplementation is not a bad idea. It's fairly inexpensive. It's easy to do. And it's really not harmful. why is it that it appears that we have a B12 deficiency when we should be getting all of our nutrients from plants and so on? Well, B12 is not made by animals. It's actually made by bacteria, and it's usually a soil bacteria that produces B12. And so the animals that are grazing on the plants that grow near the soil, they get that bacteria, populates their gut, they produce vitamin B12, they get it incorporated into their flesh, and then when you eat their flesh, you get the B12 along with it. But you're not actually getting the source. The source comes from the bacteria. And in our eating patterns nowadays, we're fairly far removed from the garden. And so we have foods that are prepared in somebody else's garden. They're washed very well, almost sanitized, and then brought to the grocery store, and then we buy it in the grocery store, and then we prepare it. And so all of these nice soil bacteria have been washed off, or there's very little of it, and so you have very little access to the B12 that they produce. So we would probably be doing much better if we were doing our own gardening and not washing our vegetables so well, so that we did get some of that contamination and we had the B12 associated with it. There's some concerns of brushing teeth and fluoride and its ability to kill a bacteria that produce B12 in the mouth. I've heard the theory, but I haven't seen any studies that are convincing related to it. So I'm not sure that it's a really big issue. But B12, you have about 3 years worth of B12 stores in the body. So if you switch over to a plant-based diet, you usually don't have to worry about B12 supplementation within the first 3 years. But it would be a good idea to just check a B12 level periodically to see where you're at. And if it looks like you're low or you're getting on the very low end of normal, go ahead and supplement. It's cheap. It's easy.
All right. It's 3:00.
Oh.
So yes. We'd like to move on to the last session of the day. I don't know if we want to, I'm afraid of saying that we'll take a break because then people, it'll take five minute break and then we'll start exactly in 5 minutes. We'll close the door and we won't let you in.